From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Sunday, February 1st, and the headline seems to be the kind of headline you would have expected to see a year ago. The headline read, "Putin must be stopped, and sometimes only guns can stop guns." For those of us who have followed Russia, Ukraine, maybe you think that's a headline from February 2014. Maybe you recall the aggression in Crimea and eastern Ukraine, the questions about what Mr. Putin was doing and what he would do next. But so often, when we see a city in flames and a region in turmoil, we give it our attention for a little while and then we move on. And I understand that. I mean, I'm certainly guilty of it myself. But there's a local community, a Ukrainian community, who wanted us on Connections to be aware of what is still happening in Ukraine and what is the concern now, because it is certainly, unfortunately, for those of us who wanted to think that things have been sort of normalized, there is still a great risk of all kinds of different possible outcomes. And so I welcome a panel here that's going to help us understand the regional setting, because the headline I read, "Putin must be stopped and sometimes only guns can stop guns," comes from The Guardian, and it comes from 2 days ago. Here's our panel. In studio, we have Irina Skrobach, who is with the town of Irondequoit. She's an Irondequoit town councilwoman, but also very active in advocacy efforts here. And nice to see you again in studio.
Wonderful to see you again. Thank you.
In studio, we have Dr. Roman Kowalczyk, who is with the radiology department at Rochester General Hospital and can tell us a lot about sort of the medical humanitarian relief efforts that have been going on. Nice to see you.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for being here. We have in studio Elena Delai, who is an associate professor of mathematics at MCC. And I think, Elena, the last time we talked about just perceptions and misperceptions of Russia, Mr. Putin, and their behavior and intentions. So I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about today.
Correct.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Olena Prokopovich is also here, who's a professor of history at Nazareth College. Nice to see you.
Good to be here.
You smiled. Did I mispronounce it?
Associate Professor of Political Science in the History and Political Science Department.
I did, but the name was okay.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Elena. And on the line with us, we have Roman Levitsky, a member of our community as well. Roman, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, good afternoon, Evan.
Everyone else. Yeah, it's good to have you on the line with us. So let me start with the question of what is happening now. And Irina Skrobach, who got in touch with me last week to say, let's not lose sight of what's happening now. It's been a while since this program has been focused on that region. And when we see a headline that talks about guns stopping guns, and we see a debate about should we be arming, should we be increasing funding, how do you talk to friends when they say, oh, I thought everything was fine in Ukraine? And, you know, Putin annexed Crimea and there was a lot of things that happened there, but we thought things had normalized. What's going on?
Sad to say, things have not normalized. Yeah. There's been Russian aggression continued in the areas of Donetsk and Luhansk. There have been thousands of lives lost, 5,100 and some odd to date, 11,000 wounded, and 1.9 million children displaced, as well as other individuals who had to move from the region. So Donetsk region and Luhansk has been and is in the present being overtaken by armored vehicles, and we're in a crisis situation in Ukraine.
That's eastern Ukraine.
Yes, it is.
And I recall talking to Elena Delai about Crimea, and when we talked about the propaganda campaign, for example, that went on before the vote, that unfortunately that kind of vote was the kind of thing that you see in, I think, of elections where I remember Saddam Hussein got 99.4% of the vote 1 year. You know, apparently there wasn't any real dissent. That's what happens when people are scared. I'm not saying that the people of Crimea didn't want one thing or another. I'm saying that when fear is a motivating factor, it's going to influence. I don't know about Donetsk and Luhansk. I don't know what people in eastern Ukraine want. Is there a way to know what? It's one thing to see what Mr. Putin is doing. It's another to wonder, is that a part of the country that's in jeopardy as well?
Well, if you ask a simple question, what do people want? People want peace.
People want peace.
People want peaceful life. If you think back, actually, in our conversation last year, after Crimea was taken over, there was a question at some point, and we discussed what might Putin do next. And actually, the answer was, oh, he will invade Ukraine. He will go for eastern Ukraine. And Donetsk and Luhansk region are the two that are most of interest for him because they had a lot of Russian-speaking population. But it doesn't mean that all those people would like to live in Russia and would like to be separate from Ukraine. And really what started as a small movement of perhaps a few individuals or some part of individuals who lived in the regions wanting to separate from Ukraine and maybe wanted to be against European Union. However, it escalated to something that is completely different. It is a global problem now, and it really has nothing to do with those few desires at the beginning of those who wanted to be away from the European Union. It is a full-blown war against Ukraine that Russia is carrying, and we might call it an anti-terrorist operation, but truly we all know this is not the right term to use. There are so many Russian military in Ukraine. Their weaponry is used by so-called separatists, which truly, by now, there are probably less of them than the actual Russian soldiers. And there are proofs that Russian soldiers are on Ukrainian ground. So people who lived there, and I say lived because most of them are running away, they really just want peace. But they are not able to get it. And I'm not sure they will be able to because Russia is really playing a big hand here. It's not just what people who live there want and what they are trying to do. It's somebody else's pushing them, trying to fulfill some agenda on their own, and that somebody else is Putin.
What do you see, Elena, as a worst-case scenario?
Worst-case scenario? I think we all would agree the World War III would be the worst, the absolute worst. For Ukraine, the worst-case scenario is right now.
That's what I mean. I mean, a worst-case scenario as a realistic possibility in that country. As in, a year ago, a lot of people said, it's not really going to happen with Crimea. And it did. What's a worst-case scenario in your eyes for developments in the next 6 to 12 months in that part of our world?
The worst-case scenario, in my opinion, would be if the world will keep doing what it's doing and saying, Russia, please stop. We don't think that what you're doing is right, but yet will not provide any real substantial help to Ukraine. And Ukraine will be left to fight on its own this very unequal battle. And if that should happen, Ukraine just might lose because they really are incapable to fight with Russian army. They're meager compared to Russian. Russian military is very strong, and we all know that Putin has been putting a lot of funds and a lot of effort into strengthening his military, and now that military is invading Ukraine. So if the world will not step in and will not help to stop the bully, most likely a year or half a year from now, we will have a situation that might be irreversible. So this is just about the highest time for the world to say, okay, well, let's just take different measures than just sanctions, than just trying to condemn Russia for what they are doing. Something else needs to be happening at this point.
Professor Prokopovich, when we look at Mr. Putin, about a year ago, he was very popular with his own people in Russia after what happened with Crimea. And I remember talking to Professor Randy Stone at the University of Rochester, among others, who said they were a little surprised that he went after Crimea because Crimea was always the low-hanging fruit that he could use as leverage, as in, appease me or I could take it. And by taking it, he loses the leverage. Well, then the question was, is he going to try to take Donetsk and Luhansk? Is that his next bit of leverage? And does it actually not suit his purposes to fully try to essentially destabilize Ukraine, to move into that region in a much more meaningful and public way? Does he want to keep the fear and sort of the thumb on the people of that region without actually moving forward? How do you view it?
Yes, first to the question of Putin's popularity. Certainly we have had reports that his ratings went through the roof after the occupation and annexation of Crimea. But it's also very hard to put much trust into the ratings that are conducted on the population that has more and more narrow channels of information flowing to them. Sociologists also have questions the validity of data that the population provides in all of these ratings. And we are already beginning to hear that not insignificant parts of Russian population, especially intellectuals, but also very ordinary people are beginning to see grave dangers in the policies that Putin is pursuing, and particularly the dangers for the Russian people themselves. Now, about the possible plans of destabilization in the eastern region of Ukraine, it is possible that Putin wants to continue to intervene militarily in the eastern region of Ukraine in order to divert all of the energy of Ukrainian government from such badly needed reforms, from the path of euro integration, and weakening its strength until perhaps it can hope to topple it and replace it with more Russian-friendly government in Kyiv. But it is also equally likely that Putin is pursuing the goals of territorial expansion of his war, that indeed he has not, as has been claimed in some media, abandoned the project of carving out more territory, either the land bridge to Crimea or even the occupation and annexation of the entire southern and eastern region of Ukraine, carrying out the threat to make Ukraine a non-naval state. Some have suggested that creating a dependent Ukraine is ultimately the goal of Mr. Putin, and that, of course, will then bring the influence of increasingly paranoid, increasingly dangerous government all the way to the borders of EU and of NATO countries.
We saw Mr. Putin somewhat embarrassed by the economic hit that Russia had taken, especially toward the end of 2014. Oil prices have certainly been a big problem. And the ruble had crashed. I think it had fallen in half at one point. And I confess, I don't know where it is now. But sanctions that were put together, among others, with the help of the White House, and oil prices embarrassed him. For those who said a year ago, when Rudy Giuliani and others were saying a real leader is someone like Vladimir Putin, who's got his shirt off and taking a picture with a tiger, which was the most bizarre thing I think I've ever heard. Now, all of a sudden, by the end of the year, he was embarrassed by that. And I wonder, Olena, do you feel when he is somewhat embarrassed or weakened, is he more volatile? Is he more likely to be aggressive in Ukraine?
It is a very good question. And Putin has been assessed by a number of world leaders and very serious observers of these events as to be very unpredictable, volatile, and hard to understand. First, about sanctions. I think sanctions are a very necessary part of the international response to what is going on in Ukraine. And Ukrainian leaders and Ukrainian people are very grateful to the unified stance of the European nations, in particular to the leading role of the United States in bringing about the regime of fairly crippling sanctions that has been imposed upon Russia, quite rightly, for the aggression that it has at least unleashed on Ukraine. No question, the sanctions must continue until Russia shows willingness to back down and to respect international norms. But unfortunately, it seems that sanctions are not enough. The observers of Russian politics have been saying that the current regime in Russia is pushing the economic concerns of the people, the question of prosperity and growth, of market relations, very much to the back burner, and pumping people up with propaganda in which economy, prosperity, jobs, incomes are becoming very secondary to the national psychosis of war, aggression, hate, etc. So while I do not believe that sanctions can or should be lifted at this moment, sanctions might not be enough. I also do not believe that President Putin should be pacified, that sanctions should be withdrawn because we're afraid of aggressive response on his part. In fact, sanctions should be backed up by providing enough defensive and maybe even offensive capability to Ukraine in order to change the calculus of Mr. Putin. The calculus should be changed to the point where he sees the costs of continued aggression in Ukraine as detrimental to his own regime. I do not believe he cares about the prosperity or well-being of the Russian people, but I think he does care about personal power. And this is where defensive capabilities of Ukraine, I think, will continue and extend the work of the sanctions in order to change his calculus.
You say you don't think he should be pacified. You don't think he should be appeased.
No.
Appeased.
Appeased, yes.
We should not, in other words, lower the sanctions because we're worried that if they're hit hard enough, the Russian people could suffer or he could be more volatile. So be it, but we need to be tough.
Yes, and unfortunately, I believe it is in the interests of Russian people as well that the West and Europe continue steady pressure and support Ukraine in its absolutely rightful struggle against the aggressor.
All right, we're going to talk about that in more detail in just a moment. We're also going to get to the phones. I know Chris in Pittsburgh's waiting. We're going to come to you in a minute, Chris. And it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Writing in The Guardian, we see this characterization of what's happening. And for those of us who've had our eyes off Ukraine for a while, this is a surprise to hear. Here's what they write in The Guardian. Vladimir Putin is the Slobodan Milosevic of the former Soviet Union. As bad, but bigger. Behind a smokescreen of lies, he has renewed his drive to carve out a puppet para-state in eastern Ukraine, as you just heard Elena and Olena tell us. Innocent bystanders, they write in The Guardian, innocent bystanders are killed in the Black Sea port of Mariupol. And in besieged Dalbatsev, a woman scoops water from a giant puddle on the road. About 5,000 people have already been killed in this conflict, more than 500,000 uprooted. Dr. Kowalczyk, 500,000 uprooted, 5,000 dead. What is the humanitarian situation?
Well, this is clearly a very severe humanitarian crisis. The newest figures have over 5,300 people who have been killed, and that does not include the Russian soldiers because it's impossible to get those figures. We have over 12,000 people who have been injured, wounded, maimed. We have somewhere between 1.2 and 1.9 million people who have been displaced. They are refugees. This is the largest refugee displacement of people in Europe since the Bosnian crisis over 20 years ago, where our president, Bill Clinton, had a very strong role to try to diminish some of those losses. But this is the largest humanitarian crisis in Europe since the Bosnian War. We have other terrorist-type deaths. We have the Malaysian airline, 298 people, including a lot of Dutch, a lot of Australians, international people. That plane was a civilian aircraft shot out of the sky with Russian military equipment. We have 224 civilians in the last 3 weeks alone who have been indiscriminately killed. We have rocket fire onto civilian populations, schools, roads, hospitals, shopping markets. This is the definition of war crimes. And so we have a very serious humanitarian crisis. We have 20% of the population of Ukraine is now under Russian military control, 5.2 million people. Many of these people don't have electricity. They don't have heat. They don't have water. It's just as cold there as it is in Rochester right now. Imagine having no heat, no electricity, and no running water. That's a humanitarian crisis of global proportions. And it's very difficult to provide aid. Earlier in the year, the Ukrainian government from Kiev was able to provide humanitarian aid and was giving that to the people of Donetsk and Luhansk. At this point, that is impossible due to the military situation. And in terms of humanitarian aid, let's just be clear. Occasionally, you'll see an article talking about humanitarian relief from Russia. When they send 200, 300 trucks of aid, what they really are doing is sending military equipment and supplies. That is not humanitarian aid in any way, shape, or form. So we have a very serious crisis here of really millions and millions of people at risk due to the Russian invasion. Now, these numbers may sound astronomical, but in terms of Ukrainian history, Ukrainians know this well. In terms of the period between World War I and World War II, there was a forced Ukrainian famine due to the leaders of Stalin, etc., and somewhere between 6 and 15 million Ukrainians were starved to death. So it's not unheard of to place millions of people at humanitarian risk, and so it's not surprising. And they have a sort of scorched earth policy. They destroy entire villages. Entire villages are just destroyed to the ground. Every single house in some of those eastern villages has been destroyed, and basically those people are displaced. And there's been a long history of resettlement.
Where are they?
They are in eastern Ukraine.
But where are they going after this happens?
They go wherever they can. Some get across the border to Russia. Some go to other parts of Ukraine. School children are all the way to western Ukraine, into Lviv, and some end up in Europe. So these people are being displaced in record numbers.
I just wanted to add that we're forgetting about the children that are involved, and there have been efforts on from Kyiv and from the Minister of Sports and Youth that we've had Skype sessions with to take those devastated lives and psychologically warped now children and take them to areas of Kyiv where they're able to spend 2 to 3 weeks or sometimes even 7 weeks in special nurturing environments where they can at least have some psychological counseling as well as support to show them that there is still some love in the air for them. But their futures are very grim and dim because they don't know where food will come tomorrow. There's been shelters that have been formed and relief monies are going there in foods and such. However, churches can only maintain X amount. So we do have to focus on providing more humanitarian relief. But the crisis is going to continue. It's not going to stop. And we really have to encourage our representatives and the president to come to a conclusive decision and come to it quickly.
All right, we're going to get to that in a second. Let me also bring in Roman Levitsky, who's on the phone with us. And you might have heard, our listeners might have heard of the Maidan movement. But Roman, what is it?
So the Maidan movement was back probably about a year or more ago. That was sort of the first organized protests against the then Ukrainian government. And that consisted of people being upset with the current living situation, the way wealth was not being distributed fairly. And then the biggest issue was the fact that Ukraine at the last second decided against moving closer toward integration with Europe. At the last second, the government decided to pull out of those discussions, and that triggered mass protests initially in Kyiv, throughout other places in Ukraine, and eventually throughout the world. So there were a lot of, I guess you can call them protests and sympathy in various cities throughout the U.S., Canada, and like I said, throughout various countries in the world. When the government was overthrown, and this was, I think, shortly before we spoke to you about a year ago, and, you know, I think we all had a much different view of where we'd be a year from now. Certainly, I didn't think we would be where we are today, but nevertheless, that's where we are. I think what's happened is with all the conflict in the eastern, southern parts of Ukraine and all the other things that's happened, some of the goals and ideals of the Maidan have just sort of been put on the back burner. I think more people have focused their attention on what's happening, as Dr. Kowalczyk so eloquently described the situation there. Those kind of things have to take precedence, not only with people in Ukraine, but all the supporters worldwide. So consequently, you know, even the group in Rochester, we have a community group called Euromaidan Rochester that we've had in place since, you know, November of 2013. That tries to support Ukraine, tries to get information out, tries to help with fundraising and so on. We've really focused a lot of our attention on trying to help the soldiers who are fighting, the victims of the battles, the casualties, and so on. That's really where the focus has gone. So it's been, you know, like I said, the Maidan movement itself, even though, you know, it's still there in theory, has really taken a back burner to the current situation.
Here's a headline in the New York Times. U.S. considers supplying arms to Ukraine forces. And I'm going to get to Chris on the phone because this is what he wants to talk about. Here's a paragraph from the New York Times. In recent months, Susan Rice, Mr. Obama's national security advisor, has resisted proposals to provide lethal assistance in Ukraine, several officials said. But one official who is familiar with her views insisted that Ms. Rice was now prepared to reconsider the issue, fearing that the provision of defensive weapons might tempt President Vladimir Putin of Russia to raise the stakes. the White House has limited American aid to non-lethal items, including body armor, night vision goggles, first aid kits, and engineering equipment so far. Chris in Pittsford, what do you want to see?
Well, I think Putin clearly is the biggest threat to world peace since World War II, and certainly is at a level of destabilization where we gauge radical Islamic extremists to be. I support covertly, quietly, more quiet than a New York Times article, sending arms in through Western Ukraine. I think the sanctions have been fantastic. They hurt Putin long-term, I believe, but short-term, if you look fairly and in a balanced way at what's going on, I think that Ukraine will become another Russian satellite country, just like the Soviet Union had satellite countries, of course, after World War II. So we saw the other day that Putin and the Russian military flew bombers down the English Channel. They were intercepted by British fighter jets. I mean, the provocativeness of Putin is unmatched in recent years, in many years. I don't even think Brezhnev or Gorbachev or anybody was as provocative as Putin, and certainly not Boris Yeltsin. So I think it's a dangerous time, and I think we have to stand up to Putin. Now, on the other hand, having said that, I don't think we want the Russians in Venezuela, Cuba, or other areas of Central and South America that are near and dear to our hearts strategically, economically, and in terms of having common interests. So there is a danger in this, but I do think we need to stand up for Ukrainians in some quiet but military sense. And I'll listen to your guests' comments off the air. Thank you very much.
Chris, thank you. Let me get back to Roman Levitsky first, and then we'll go around the panel inside the room. Roman, what do you think?
I tend to agree with Chris. I think he stated it very well. I think the sanctions have done a good job as far as they can, but I don't think sanctions are a be-all and end-all. And I think some type of military strength in some way, and I don't profess to know. I agree with Chris. Maybe it's something that needs to be sort of a covert operation or something like that rather than all out. But I think something like that needs to follow on, because I think, as we can see, the sanctions aren't enough. The sanctions will hurt the people in Russia. They may hurt some of the rich people eventually and so on. But I think before Putin truly feels the effect of those, I think many, many others are going to feel the effect first. So I don't know that that's a short-term solution if we're talking about trying to fix the scenario that's unfolding with the invasion of eastern Ukraine.
One of the goals, or one of the hopes with the economic sanctions, was that it would dissuade Russia from sending heavy weapons and military personnel into eastern Ukraine. It has not done that. And
no.
The New York Times writes, fueling the broader debate over policy is an independent report issued Monday by 8 former senior American officials who urged the U.S. to send $3 billion in defensive arms and equipment to Ukraine, including anti-armor missiles, reconnaissance drones, armored Humvees, and radars that can determine the location of enemy rocket and artillery fire. Professor Prokopovich, I've already had listeners this hour saying, does this mean we're entering another war in Ukraine? I understand the American appetite for war is very low here. So how do you sell this as a necessary to people who are on the fence and feel armed conflict is not something they want to feel involved in?
I would argue that this is quite the opposite. Instead of entering the broader war, we're trying to prevent the broader war from breaking out on the global scale, quite possibly. I want to address first the point that is sometimes brought up, that supplying lethal military aid, even of defensive kind, to Ukraine would raise the stakes, would allow Putin to say that, look, West is helping, is behind the Ukrainian government. We're much past the point where that is even relevant. Putin's government has flooded the information space of his own country with fraudulent but massive wave of claims, all of them baseless, that in fact Ukraine government is not an independent voice of its people, but rather a creation of the West. So those arguments are no longer necessary. In fact, such reports have been circulating in Russian media sphere for a long time. And I do believe that in this, sort of the old medical adage really applies. An ounce of prevention is worth the pound of cure. The goal must be to constrain further expansion of Russian aggression. Because if more territory is taken, if more conflict is sown, if more violence, if more war is sown in the territory of Ukraine, as well as in other places, North Caucasus, for example, is another area where Russia is tightening its grip on those quasi-independent secessionist regions, it will only whet the appetite of the Russian military machine, of the government that is now entirely based on the whipped up patriotic sort of feelings.
I assume this panel is, are you unified in support of this notion of $3 billion in defensive arms and equipment for Ukraine? Anybody, Professor Delay, you're nodding? Go ahead.
Absolutely so. I would like to also just reflect on the fact that Budapest Agreement was signed in 1996, and we don't mention it anymore, but still, there is this obligation that the signers of that agreement have. And Ukraine had a third largest in the world nuclear weapon arsenal, which it gave up. So now it's the time for those countries who signed the agreement to step in and help out. The sanctions, by all means, I truly believe that they are much necessary. They did a lot of good, and they will do more good in the future, but it's a long-term solution. And by all means, they should not be lifted. However, we tried sanctions, and so far it hasn't done what we hoped it would. Putin is not backing off. Since the European Union is not as united as one would hope, we have Greece, we have Hungary, we have countries that are pro-Russian there. It is hard to get much needed for Ukraine help and support from them, probably. And I'm very happy to hear that U.S. even is considering giving the military, much needed military support to Ukraine, because perhaps they should be the first ones to show the lead and start this trend of helping Ukraine.
Jake writes to us, these sanctions and the oil price crash will really start affecting the Russian public more over the next year, which should pretty seriously affect Putin's popularity. Isn't this just a waiting game now? I worry with recent suggestions of sending arms, that increases a proxy war between nuclear powers, and that could be a bad precedent to set. Irina, what do you think? Doctor, I'll start with Dr. Kowalczyk. Go ahead.
It's interesting you bring up nuclear powers in part of your question. And just to underscore the Budapest Memorandum, this was an agreement signed in 1994. Ukraine was a party to that. It was signed with the United Kingdom, the United States, and Russia, and subsequently France and China signed on to that agreement. At that time, Ukraine was the third largest nuclear power in the world. They had 5,000 nuclear weapons on their soil. And as part of the agreement to give up those nuclear weapons and to join the nations of non-nuclear nations, that agreement bound those five signatories to respect and protect the integrity of Ukraine's borders. It didn't say exactly how that should happen, but something is responsible there. That's part of the responsibility of that agreement. So those signatories have a responsibility. Obviously, Russia has completely abrogated that by virtue of its invasion, but those other signatories really are duty-bound to provide sufficient support in order to respect those integratory boundaries. The sanctions have only gone so far. When you have somebody who really understands force and the risk of force, then you need to match it with some force. And certainly the U.S. government and NATO and the European Union have some flexibility into what to do, but now it's time to step up. There are certainly easy things to consider. We had a plan to put in missiles into Czechoslovakia and Poland. We could suggest that we're going to put those back on the table. At least that's something for Mr. Putin to think about. We could put ships in the Black Sea. At least it's something to think about. We can send $3 billion worth of aid. That would be helpful. To kind of give you a scale, we've sent a few hundred millions of dollars of aid over the last 18 months to Ukraine. Pakistan, a nuclear power, in the 9 years after 9/11, received $18 billion worth of aid, and two-thirds of that aid was military assistance. So we sent 12 $1 billion of military assistance to Pakistan, and as of yet, we haven't sent any military assistance to Ukraine.
I think to Jake's question, though, he may not be disagreeing with any of that. He may be saying we're not being patient enough for the impact to really start hitting Russia, Mr. Putin, and that will convince him to back off without what he considers a proxy war. Obviously, the panel is saying, unfortunately, you disagree with that. Mm-hmm. Did you want to jump in, Professor?
If I may.
Yeah, yes.
There is logic to waiting and to being pragmatic. I think what was proposed by a very reputable group of scholars associated with the Brookings Institutions and the Atlantic Council in the report that you referred to is a very wise policy recommendation. I think the fundamental task right now is not necessarily to go on the attack, but to not allow further encroachment of Russians onto the territory of Ukraine. And what we have seen since September is the ability of Russian aggression to actually spread further into Ukraine from the borders that were fixed by the Minsk agreement in September. In other words, they're making gains. That is absolutely unacceptable. Ukraine on its own is bleeding economically and militarily, and it has very hard time even keeping the border, the front, where it was in September under the Minsk agreement. And I think it is the time for the Western powers, for the European powers, to provide lethal and defensive capabilities to Ukraine to push back at least to the front line of the Minsk agreement. Nobody wants unnecessary provocation. Nobody counsels for greater losses of human life.
Sure.
But the aggression must be stopped from spreading.
So, Irina, it's like if we live in a neighborhood and everyone's yard butts up to one another with fences, and you come home one day and your neighbor has cut down your fence and is cutting his fence into your yard, first you may ask him to stop. And if he doesn't stop, it's not a case of you starting a fight with a neighbor. It's saying, I am not going to allow you to carve up my yard and take it for yourself. That's not an aggressive war. That's defending myself. Is that the analogy here?
I would say so. We if we look at this globally, we are actually in a situation where we see the division that is occurring, and it has already happened. Ukrainian President Poroshenko was here, invited to speak to the joint session of Congress that included the House of Representatives as well as the Senate. And he had made beautiful speeches, and in it he had said, you cannot win a war with blankets. We are beyond that right now. The humanitarian aspect of supplying medical supplies has gone. We have to make the hard, concrete decisions of what do we provide to this country for defending itself, anti-tank, anti-missiles. Whether they be in covert, whether they be in an open, we have to draw the line, and it has become time. And if the United States does back itself up with providing those military defensive needs, you will have Canada following, you will have Poland following, you will have probably the UK following also.
I'm way late for a 60-second break, and when we come back, Molly has a question for the panel, wants to know about the state of the current leadership in Ukraine, and if you want to join the conversation, you can. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Back in 60 seconds on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we're talking marijuana and beer. The first hour, we talk to Josh Stanley, a man who's helped reform the medical marijuana system in a couple of other states. He's now living in New York State, helping our state prepare for dispensing medical marijuana. Second hour, why is Budweiser so afraid of craft beer? You might have seen their new Super Bowl ad. We'll break it down on Connections.
Prices at the pump are lower no matter where you go. But at certain gas stations around the country, the fuel costs even less.
It's definitely savings. It's like I got a bonus.
Why small independent gas stations can undersell the competition.
Can't offer best price like we do.
That story later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
this afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about the state of Ukraine today. Unfortunately, a year after so many events led to not only Kiev burning, but also the question of what was happening in eastern Ukraine, the annexation of Crimea, the questions over Donetsk and Luhansk and parts of the eastern region of Ukraine. For those of us who had hoped that Mr. Putin's aggression would end there, unfortunately, the evidence is that that is not the case. And our panel is a group of five people from the local community with ties to Ukraine. And in a moment, we're going to talk about what they have been doing specifically. But I also want to get Molly's question in there. Molly writes to the program and just wants to know about the current leadership of Ukraine. And I suspect when those of us who loosely follow the events there, when you're used to years of Viktor Yanukovych and many others, you wonder if their successors will be corrupt or if there is some level of public respect, how things are there. So I will start with Elena. You're smiling. How do you answer that question?
How do you answer that question? Well, you see, the government is new, very new government. And the government is in a very, very difficult situation. They took a country in a distress, and they're trying to prove to the world that they are a democratic country, and they're trying to fight corruptions and restructure the government and get new trustworthy people into the government. And it's a huge job to do. It's a very difficult undertaking. But it's not as simple because they have a war to fight. And if you put yourself in their position, they are in a very tough situation. Overall, I think Ukrainian people should be satisfied with the government. I think the government is doing an excellent job. The President Poroshenko has done everything he possibly humanly could to bring the country to a respected level in the global community. And I think they are doing what they possibly can at this point. It is very difficult to fight a war and do everything that needs to be done by the new government. So overall, I think the people are satisfied.
Anyone want to disagree, by the way, on the quality of Mr. Poroshenko's job? I can't imagine a harder job. You come into a country that is dealing with a war. Your public posture with regards to Mr. Putin is going to be heavily scrutinized. I know how difficult it can be. Go ahead, Rim. What do you think?
I just wanted to also say that not only President Poroshenko, but Prime Minister Yatsenyuk is doing a phenomenal job also under difficult situations with changes in parliament, et cetera, trying to enact some of the reforms that are needed to be even more solidly like a European nation. And it is interesting that Prime Minister Yatsenyuk said, this was barely 10, 12 days after Yanukovych left office, that in the immediate aftermath of all those changes, he said, give us a year or two or three, and Mr. Putin will do something that nobody else has been able to do, which is to unify all Ukrainians, Russian-speaking Ukrainians, Ukrainian-speaking Ukrainians, other-speaking Ukrainians, all Ukrainians. And I think Prime Minister Yatsenyuk is absolutely right. All Ukrainians have been united now against the regime of Putin.
Roman Levitsky, does it sound to me like if we can move Mr. Putin out of his aggressive stance in eastern Ukraine, give that part of the country some time to heal, that for the first time in many years there is a feeling of the populace that there is some level of respect, and do we use the word trust in government, that maybe we can rebuild and go and move forward without an obscene abuse of the public and its trust?
I think that's true, Evan, from what I've seen. I don't know if that's true across all of Ukraine, but certainly with family and friends that I have that I've talked to, the view is a positive one. And I think with the amount of effort that was put into the Maidan and everything else, I think people want to be able to give this government a chance to actually focus on improving things within the country. I think that was the goal, and that's what they would do if they were able to, and not dealing, you know, with other crises. So I tend to agree.
I was going to go back to the phones. Joel Naranjkovic, we lost his call. So Joel, if your call dropped, if you want to join the program, you can call back. In the meantime, let me ask Irina Skrobach just about efforts that are being made in this community. I know there are outreach efforts, there are fundraising efforts. What's going on?
Yes. I also just wanted to add one piece.
Sure, sure.
In terms of the reform efforts that President Petro Poroshenko has enacted, he also appointed the Minister of Finance. Her name is Natalie Yaresko, and she is from Chicago, American-born Ukrainian, who now has, over the past 20 years, have had Ukrainian citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a former partner in Horizon Capital and economic budget reforms. Very well known, very well spoken, known in Washington also, and she's making headway. And as a matter of fact, this morning she was speaking to the Atlantic Council, had put on a formal question and answer and presentation by her. So his reform efforts in the financial aspects and budgetary have been quite substantial in Ukraine to ward out corruption. So thank you for asking about the humanitarian
sure.
outreach. What we are doing, Rock Euromaidan Advocacy for Ukraine Committee has done a number of things over the past year with the support of local Ukrainian churches as well as local groups, leadership groups of Ukrainian Women's Caucus. There's a Ukrainian Cultural Center, and they have been gathering funds, sending military assisted medical supplies to different areas as well as clothing drives and such. Actually, there's going to be a concert that will include the Bandurist Choir and a chorus coming in from, I believe it's Michigan, and there that will occur on March 15th. That's a Sunday at Huckstein School, and tickets can be acquired by going to their website, Bandura, or at the Ukrainian Credit Union, that there are specific efforts for that. At the Credit Union also, there is our special accounts set up for anyone willing to donate to the Ukrainian cause. So if you call the credit union, you are able then to access those accounts and give. So there's quite a few, quite a bit of outreach that's occurring there right now. But I did want to speak a little bit on advocacy for Ukraine, and it's just not for Ukrainians in the world and Rochester and such. It's for the general community, those people who believe in having support for Ukraine because of the crisis that's occurring, and to advocate by calling and the White House at 202-456-1111 and stating too and leaving a message that we support the Freedom Support Act for Ukraine of 2014. By that message alone, it will instill the fact that that support of the American populace is needed and give that. That is the best and strongest, as well as calling your local representatives, Congresswoman Slaughter, who has been instrumental in the variety of different acts and bills that have been presented in Washington. So I would totally encourage also calling and connecting with the senators, Gillibrand, as well as Schumer, to activate their position and support for Ukraine.
All right, let me jump back to the phones. And again, Ukrainian Credit Union to contribute.
Yeah, a special account at the Ukrainian
Special
Credit
account
Union.
There, and Huckstein, March 15th.
Yes.
For the concert.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that, do I have those, do
yes,
I have that right?
Do.
We've got, okay,
Thank
we've got
you.
The schedule. This is David in Rochester. Go ahead, David.
Yes, I'm originally from Riga, Latvia, and our opinion is that Putin is much more dangerous than people are talking about. He, in economic sense, will not stop him. His goal is to take over all the former Soviet republics and to give some aid, defensive aid, to Ukraine is ridiculous not to do that. Without Russian tanks and everything like that, Putin wouldn't be where he is now.
You're getting a lot of nodding heads here, David. Thanks for the call. Anyone want to disagree? Anyone want to add to that?
Just say I think it's imperative that they get some defensive aid because they lack those. They can't fight that against the Russian tanks. So they need all that help, and that it won't change unless they get that help.
Okay. David, thanks for the call. Let me ask Professor Prokopovich just real briefly. Do you agree with his assessment that Putin's endgame is that broad and aggressive? And I've got a minute to solve Putin, which we can't do. But why? I mean, what does he reasonably expect to gain?
I believe this assessment is unfortunately correct. At this point, it is hard to understand the desire to reestablish sort of imperial space, but all of the actions so far, and they include not just a military aggression, but also information war that reaches not only into the space of the former Soviet republics, but far into Europe and even into the United States as well. So all of the components of Russian politics do point out to the desire to reestablish something resembling the former Soviet Union or the Tsarist Empire in Russia. It is very hard to understand for Americans and for Europeans this kind of. There were early hopes after the fall of the Soviet Union that Russia, as well as other former Soviet republics, will actually join the family of democratic nations of Europe and the West. Those hopes were dashed, and Russia has veered into extreme authoritarianism, now with the touches of totalitarianism to it. We cannot understand the reasoning, but I think we have to admit that there are signs that point to it, and we must do what we can to stop this development from getting even more dangerous for the world.
Now let me ask Irina one more quick question. We got about a minute left. You mentioned support, especially with defensive arms, whether it's covert or overt. Has this country had a rough history enough with covert support? Would you say, hey, keep it above board? Let's be public about it. If we're going to send support, let's send support. Let's tell the world we're sending support.
Absolutely. And I think that the fact that Breedlove and the Brookings Institute and the officials have actually put their stamp on it, and I think that they've probably been discussing this for many, many months.
Sure.
And realize that it is time. And thus, we must move forward.
I want to thank all of you for taking the time to update us. And I'm guilty myself of sort of laxing into the last half of 2014 and taking my eyes off this. And to some degree, it's easy for the people of Ukraine to feel forgotten. I hope you'll all keep us as up to date as you can. I know Irina will, but I hope you all do. Roman Levitsky, thanks for taking the time to join the program by phone. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan, very much.
Elena, Roman Kowalczyk, Irina Skrobach, thank you all for being here. We appreciate your time and expertise.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you for listening. If you couldn't get through on the phone lines this hour, we appreciate all the effort and all the great listener feedback these 2 hours of Connections. Val LeBanc, a great job engineering the program. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections on member-supported public radio.